From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette. Okay, this next story sounds like a plot to a great whodunit movie, but here's the twist. It's true, and it's all being uncovered in a new book called The Fisherman and the Dragon. I'm going to let our next guest, the author of the book, Kirk Wallace, explain more. Kirk, it's really good to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So Kirk, give us the synopsis, basically, of this story, because when I read it, I mean, honestly, I think my jaw dropped, and I actually thought, okay, is this true or did he make this up?
Yeah, you know, I wrote the thing, and I still feel that way. It's shocking to me that all of this happened. But the quick version, this is a book about a clash between Vietnamese refugees who were resettled here after the fall of Saigon. They started rebuilding their lives along the Texas Gulf Coast as shrimpers and crabbers, and became so good at it that the whites that traditionally dominated that industry freaked out, and they ran to the Texas governor for a ban on refugees. And this is in the late 70s, early 80s. And when that failed, the Ku Klux Klan was invited to join the conflict. And what ensued was a pretty garish campaign of violence and harassment against Vietnamese, where boats were torched, homes were burnt, and the Klan carried out boat patrols throughout Galveston Bay, where hooded and armed Klansmen, marauded the bay looking for Vietnamese shrimpers to menace, basically. So the story, it's so much more than that, but that's what's at the heart of it, is this turf war.
And with that said, Kirk, I mean, let's kind of dig into this, because as you said, this was the 1970s, right? So this is after the civil rights movement. And I think sometimes we forget that not only was there this kind of xenophobia going on post the civil rights movement, it's still going on today. And there seems to be, I think, some correlations with this whole idea of, you know, if you weren't born here, you don't belong here, kind of attitude.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, there were so many moments during this investigation where I would stumble across quotes or publications from back then, you know, from the white supremacist movement, where I thought it was, you know, it could have been from the last couple of years. You know, they're condemning refugees as being the source of all of our problems. There were schematics on how to build a wall at the border to keep immigrants out. The thing that really is at the heart of all of this is that this story played out on a coastline that was being poisoned by the petrochemical industry, and all of these big plants that were dumping all of this toxic stuff in the bays and killing off the shrimp and crabs. And there were all these big structural forces that were basically driving this way of life to extinction. You know, we poured concrete over all the estuaries for hotels and highways. But the whites didn't notice or didn't pay attention to all of that. They were whipped up by this demagogue that told them that it wasn't, you know, Exxon or Formosa or Dow Chemical. It was just this group of 50 or 60 Vietnamese shrimpers. They're the reason why things in your life aren't going great. And if we can just get rid of them, then everything will be great again.
And in your book, Kirk, I mean, you really uncover a lot of, I guess we could call them hidden secrets, right? I mean, including confessions to crimes that weren't solved for more than 40 years. Talk to us about, I mean, how you were able to do that, and I mean, and what you found out.
Well, after Vietnamese boats started getting firebombed, the FBI and the ATF spent something like 3 or 4 years investigating, and they never found out who set these fires. When I discovered this story about 3.5 years ago. You know, I did a kind of obsessive investigation with hundreds of interviews, thousands of hours sitting across from Klansmen, from the refugees, from law enforcement, from the lawyers on each side. And there's something that always, you know, it surprises me, even though I feel like I should know it at this point, which is that people want to talk about what they've done. There's something to do with, maybe it's male ego and vanity. I don't know, but there were some interviews where I thought I was going to have to do this very delicate surgical approach to back them into a corner to get them to confess. But sometimes it was within a couple of minutes, they would just say, "Oh yeah, I did it. Oh yeah, I burnt that cross there." Or, "No, yeah, I threw that Molotov cocktail at that Vietnamese person's home."
Oh my gosh.
So there were some shocking moments. There was one where a guy kind of unloaded these really insane stories about what he had done to harass the Vietnamese. And I think he could tell that I was a little taken aback, and he just beamed and he said, "Just make sure you spell my name right." And then he spelled it out for me. And again, I'm doing all of this with a recorder right in front of me. So it's not like I'm doing this for sneaky circumstances. They know I'm an author out to investigate what happened in this story.
Yeah. And I want to go back a little bit to what you mentioned earlier. And this is how these, really the Gulf Coast, right, was poisoned by oil spills, by pesticides, you know, things like that. And talk to us about this woman, and I believe you ended up interviewing her, correct? Where she actually, in the midst of this, in the 70s, when these white fishermen wanted to put all of the blame on these refugees and put blinders on to it possibly being anything else, she actually was noticing what was going on and took record of it, correct?
That's right. Her name is Diane Wilson, and I mean, I did many, many, many interviews with her. She's an astonishing and inspiring individual. I don't think the book would be what it is without her in it. But she lived through all of the events of the book. She's a fourth generation shrimper. She was the lone female shrimper on the Texas coastline. And she saw that everyone's nets were coming up light, but also that they were coming up with mutated crabs and shrimp. And she suspected the plants, the chemical plants, as being behind all of this. But she knew everyone was kind of willfully blind to it, because a lot of these fishermen work at those plants in the off season, or their wives do, or their parents do. Mm-hmm. And she kept telling them, "Look, it's not these Vietnamese, it's not the refugees, that we should be taking on the plants." And none of the men listened to her, and she set off on her own on an incredible 30-year, it's still going, battle, where she lost just about everything dear to her. She was turned into a pariah in her hometown. Her husband left her. It's an astonishing story where she did hunger strikes for a month at a time, and she just 2 years ago won the largest ever settlement in U.S. history under the Clean Water Act by taking on one of these plants.
Wow.
She herself still lives off of $425 a month from Social Security. She's 74 and she represents basically one of the last best hopes for any fisherman on that coastline, whether they're white or Vietnamese, mm-hmm. because she's trying to use that money to clean these bays up and to revive the industry.
And in the midst of all of this back in the 70s, and you mentioned how, you know, these white fishermen go to the governor of Texas, you know, they try to lobby there, and then the KKK comes along to get behind them. What an unfortunate incident happens. I mean, a tragic incident. A white crabber is killed by a young Vietnamese refugee in self-defense. I mean, this lights the tinderbox, right, Kirk, for, I mean, everything to truly explode. And this comes into you know, the news. I mean, you even say there's a Bruce Springsteen song written about all of this. So what happens then?
Yeah, you know, and that Springsteen song is, ironically, that's how I discovered this story. I didn't know about any of this until I heard that song. And I thought he was basing it all on kind of a fictional premise until I realized what he was singing about. Mm. But yeah, as you said, there was a, you know, the tension was climbing between these two camps, and there was a white crabber who just had it out for this 18-year-old Vietnamese crabber who he thought had dropped his traps too close to his. He kept giving him death threats in town. He raised a rifle at him once, slashed his tires, and that refugee ended up buying a pistol because he was worried about his safety. And after he was pummeled by the white crabber and slashed across the chest, he pulled his gun out and shot the white crabber dead. He was eventually acquitted by an all-white jury on grounds of lawful self-defense. But that acquittal basically, you know, it turned the white crabber into a martyr. It sort of amplified the tensions or the anger by the among the white fishermen against the Vietnamese, and the Klan ultimately came in. And for so long, when I was doing this investigation, I couldn't figure out why the Klan cared so much about the fate of this small town crabber, but it wasn't until I managed to get his widow to talk that she confessed that they had joined the Klan a year or two prior to all of this. So that's another kind of mystery that the book solves, that people on that coast have been talking for decades about just why the Klan got involved. It's because one of their own was killed by one of these refugees.
And, you know, and then here we are in 2022, and we have seen once again this rise, in the sense of it's been underground more, right, of the white nationalist movement. And we're seeing, you know, conflict again, I mean, in all parts of the country. I mean, how did that resonate to you or within you when you were writing this book? And I think probably seeing certain, you know, comparisons to 40 some years ago.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I you know, authors often want to say that they come into a story with no bias, and I'll be honest, like I have a bias in the sense that I believe that our country is helped and strengthened by refugees, but also that I think we owe those who are fleeing the wars of our own doing. I spent 10 years of my life trying to get my Iraqi colleagues out. I served in Fallujah with USAID. And I had, a year and a half before starting this book, had been vocally involved in trying to overturn President Trump's refugee ban. So these are issues that are very near and dear to me. Now, I don't write in the book that they're all saints by definition, and that refugees didn't do anything wrong in this instance. They made mistakes along the way, for sure. But at the heart of this book is a kind of theme about who gets to be an American, and who gets a piece of the American pie, and what do we owe those fleeing these wars of ours, and also because this became a kind of, you know, everyone was focused on the turf war, but no one was paying attention to the turf itself and the kind of destruction of the environment. But it's a story about, you know, how much are we willing to sacrifice now for some short-term jobs that may end up killing the environment or killing ourselves? I mean, this coastline, it's called the Cancer Belt, and people there have 160 times the cancer rate the rest of the country. I was able to tell who worked at what plant by the type of cancer that they have. And so, you know, they're under attack on all fronts, but because of a demagogue that swept in, they were convinced that their enemy, that the threat was an insignificant number of refugees who frankly didn't want to come in the first place. No one wants to become a refugee. So those themes are are playing out, as you said, like in every city and every industry in this country. We're always susceptible to getting whipped up against the littlest people amongst us, oftentimes missing the real cause of our problems.
Well, I thank you for writing this book, for bringing this to the attention of our community now. The book is called The Fisherman and the Dragon. We've been talking with author Kirk Wallace Johnson. We should also make a note. The George Clooney's production company has the rights to the book, and there is a script in the works right now for a multi-part series. Kirk, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it's an honor to be here.
Absolutely. We have been, as I said, talking with Kirk Wallace Johnson. His book is available now. I want to thank all of you for joining us today. I'm Gemma Gaudette.